Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 198. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today, we discuss GIS in CRM with Heather McDaniel McDevitt, a California archaeologist and principal investigator. Let's get to it. Welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, everyone. Paul, how you doing?
Doing fine. Nothing new to report. I've just been, doing little projects here and there. I decided to redo my contour map that I did at the end of 2021 with the drone data that I collected at Lagash, because this last season we had an RTK GNSS receiver and we placed a whole bunch of benchmarks. So instead of when I did it before, I just had to average the elevations one flight against the other. But now I actually have some real on the ground, very accurate elevation points. So I reprocessed the entire thing. And I'm just kind of waiting around trying to find out if I'm going to go to Saudi Arabia or not. It keeps on getting kicked down. It's a rolling 1 to 2 week window.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. It's crazy to just have to be prepared for such a distant and long-term trip. You know what I mean? It's just, it's tough to prepare for. You can't do anything. So anyway, that's like a lot of CRM projects. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, we're going to start. We're just waiting on a permit. And it's like, my God, I got to do something, you know? So
I'd be happy if I had an income again.
Wouldn't that be nice? So, all right. Well, we have another interview today, and it's actually somebody that you guys in our audience here may have heard from before, because if you listen to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, Heather has been on the podcast for a few years now, and she has been a really valuable source of just wisdom and insight on that podcast because of her position and her experience in archaeology and what she's done and in CRM in particular, and on the business side of CRM and just project management and just all kinds of stuff. And it turns out she's got a real passion, as I think, well, probably as most people that get to a certain level kind of have to, but for GIS. And we talked last fall about getting her on to just talk about GIS and the context that she works with it at her firm and just her interests in GIS around that stuff. But for whatever reason, couldn't get the interview nailed down. So now we're going to do it. And I will formally welcome Heather to the Archaeotech Podcast. How's it going?
Hi. Thanks, Chris. What a nice introduction. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. So, I mean, you're literally at work, probably have ArcGIS open on one of your screens right now. So, you know, that's just the life of that kind of person, right? But let's just kick this off. When we first started talking about this and you're like, you know, I could come on and talk GIS stuff, what were your thoughts around that? What's your passion around this?
After I got my graduate degree in archaeology, I was working regularly, but I didn't have a actual full-time job nailed down. So I was working for a company. They really didn't hire full-time people. It's a very small company that was predominantly paleo. And so I didn't really see a whole lot of opportunity there. And I was trying to find my way in the archaeology world, CRM world. And I had gotten a GIS certificate while I was going through graduate school for archaeology. And I thought, you know, at the time, the chair of the department for the GIS department had really been trying to push some interdisciplinary graduate students. So people that were from other disciplines coming in to get a graduate degree in GIS. And at the time I thought, you know, this might be a really good opportunity for me to increase my skill set. And so I decided, you know, I was going to try to do that. They were making it very attractive for me, wasn't going to cost much. And and they, because they were really working hard to get some other disciplines in. And so, and I actually really loved the department. It was such a great environment altogether. The professors are amazing, very invested. And so I decided I was going to take my my thesis work and then expand it and look at predictive modeling and get a GIS master's. Mm. And so I went into the master's program for the GIS department after I graduated, and I was still working full time, but hadn't quite had that full time position yet. While I was in graduate school, I nailed down a full time job with the company I'm with now, actually.
Yeah.
And at the time, they sold me because they were going to have me do 40% GIS and 60% archaeology. And so it really is what got my foot in the door, that along with my skill sets with human osteology and faunal analysis, which they did not have at the time. So GIS was a great window opener for me, door opener, I guess. But as I started making my way up the ladder, at some point, they took GIS away from me. They wouldn't even let me have access to ArcGIS because they didn't want me tempted to work with it because I had other stuff I needed to do. And I do enjoy, you know, there were some times where, you know, on GIS, they get overloaded and it's just easy enough for me to go in there and make what I need. Mm-hmm. But we do use GIS just for analysis and just to kind of wrap our head around, you know, certain tasks. And so I still do use GIS. I'm not fully GIS, really. It's just a tool.
You've got people for that now. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like doing it like that, but yes, I mean, it is. I have too much on my plate for that now.
Yeah,
I leave it to the people that are keeping up with it. That's the other thing, is I try to keep up with it, but it is something that you do have to exercise. You know, it's not something you can just do and then step away and then come back and be able to pick it up like you had no time missed. Now I can, it's like riding a bike. I go in there and I, you know, look around and it's intuitive to me, but it takes some time for me to get to refamiliarize myself if I've been away from it for a while, especially things change, right? Things are updated but I don't get to do the analysis. I have done some. Probably the last time I did any kind of predictive modeling was about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. That was serious predictive modeling.
Okay. Your graduate certificate, let's just go back to the beginning a little bit here. Were you required to do any a special project for that, or was it all coursework? Or
it was a 3-year program, and it was very similar to the way it was set up for the archaeology masters. And that was two years of robust classes. And then, which I'd already taken quite a few, right? Hmm. So I'd already got my certificate. I had done a suite. It was a suite of 5 classes. And and that's actually what kind of hooked me, which was smart on their part. And then I did a few more classes because I enjoyed it so much. So I'd already kind of knocked out quite a few of the classes needed for the master's. And then the project was the predictive modeling. So I'm in the Santa Barbara area, Santa Barbara Channel region, comparing the Channel Islands with the mainland.
Oh, okay. That's pretty cool.
It's fun because, you know, there's not a lot, there's so much work done on the islands, and you would think the other way around, right? But there's just a ton of work done on the island, on the northern, specifically Northern Channel Islands. And there's, you know, comparatively not as much on the mainland. There's, you know, a good amount, but if you were to compare relative, there's more there. And the academic, the research is predominantly academic out on the islands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a little curious about the sense of not being current in it if you're not using it all the time. Is that, I mean, GIS tools are so common now, and we use them for so many kinds of visualizations. Do you mean with respect to the predictive modeling, which is a fairly advanced use of GIS, or do you just mean in general that jumping into any, you know, dark GIS looks different because you haven't used it in a year and you'd need to refresh yourself with it?
That's such a great question, because I think most people, when they're looking at getting a GIS degree and they're trying to say, or they want to get a certificate like I did, or a lot of places don't have that, or just taking a few classes so they can say they have that skill set, they need to understand that it's completely different. Like having the ability to create figures is not the same as GIS. So GIS in its definition is actual analysis. It's a science, and it's geographical information science, right? And if you really, if you have a degree in GIS, like an actual full degree in GIS, not just taking a few classes while you have another degree, and it specifically if you have one in a graduate degree, it is focused on how do you analyze with the data. So the initial classes that you take are really, they're really about, which are all important. They're really about how to create figures, how to do initial data, mining data analysis, but it's not heavy duty at all. And a lot of it is also cartography, learning how to communicate data in a figure, which is key. Like you can have, there's so many maps. I don't know how much you guys are into maps, but you know, there are really good examples of very poor maps that don't communicate. Yeah. They may be pretty, but they don't make any sense. So that that's a big part of GIS too.
That's such a good thing to say too, right? Because it's not just about doing the analysis. I actually heard somebody tell me last night, he's this kind of older guy and he's got all these colloquialisms, but he said one I hadn't personally heard before. He's like, nobody needs a drill. They need a hole. They just need a drill to do the hole, right? So he's trying to say, what's the actual problem you're trying to solve here? You don't want to, you don't want to buy that. So nobody needs GIS. They need maps. They need analysis and they need answers. But GIS happens to be the best tool for that job. So, but if you don't give an output that somebody can make sense with, then you just wasted all your time, right? Because what's the point?
Yes.
So
yes, and I have another thought, a way of looking at that from another perspective. But I don't know if you want to take it on the next, in the next segment.
Let's take a break and then we'll open with that on the other side. So we'll be back in just a minute.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to episode 198 of the Archaeotech Podcast. And we're sitting here talking to Heather McDaniel McDevitt about her GIS and her GIS work and the stuff that she does at her firm. She's not a GIS specialist, but this is just such a great conversation because, I mean, even if you don't feel like you need to learn GIS in your life for whatever reason, you're using GIS products and it's helpful to understand mechanism around this thing, even if you just have a cursory knowledge of it, to understand how these things are put together so you can better articulate to the people at your firm that do these things what you need, right? Because there's always two different sets. And that's what we were just kind of talking about, is you've got the people putting data together and putting all these maps and things together. But if they can't put an output in that either you understand or somebody can understand in a way that you actually need it, then everybody's just kind of wasting their time there. And you had some more to kind of talk on that subject, Heather, before the break.
Sure. Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, Chris. I think that, you know, it goes both ways. Let's say you're trying to get an archaeology job and the job description says that you must have some kind of command of GIS. Typically, what a CRM firm is looking for is somebody who can create figures. Mm-hmm. It's not analysis. And so if, you know, if anybody's ever really, you know, looking for a job and they look at that and they just being able to take GIS and create appropriate figures, which are typically the same thing almost every time, right? You want a project location, you want a project vicinity. There are two different types. And this may be more specific to California where I work, but I know, you know, I've worked outside of California too. We use those as well. Basically a overview. Where does your site, project site, fit in the grand scale of things? And where is your site actually? So a lot of times that's more of a zoomed in, where you can look at the type, the characteristics, traits of the site. And then then you have a site plan and those types of things. And so most of those are just, yes, you're working with GIS to communicate aspects of your project, but you're not doing analysis. What's the difference between creating a figure and doing analysis? Analysis mm-hmm. is just bringing in all this data and trying to figure out something that you wouldn't be able to figure out or wouldn't be able to communicate, both figure out and communicate without a tool that can take all this data and spit out things that overlap.
Right.
Just to make it as simple as possible. So, you know, if let's say one thing you're trying to look at, you know, predictive modeling, you put in the traits of the sites that you do know that are there, and then you look at the commonalities between those sites, and then you try to find that on your landscape in areas that you don't. Let's say you have a larger area, a county or a city, and you apply the set of data that overlaps and mm-hmm. you put it on your area that you're looking at, and it allows you to have certain areas that pop up and tell you, okay, this fits your parameters here. This may have a higher probability of having a site. So all this is, that's analysis. You see it a lot in biology and a lot of with habitat. And, you know, we're humans, right? Habitat's important to us too. So in biology, I think GIS is probably used more in biology than a lot of the other technical disciplines if you work in an environmental firm that has multi-disciplines. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's one thing that people need. I think a lot of people don't realize that when a CRM company is asking that you have some GIS knowledge, it's typically so you can make a figure. And a figure is important, but a figure is not analysis.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. More of a representation, right, of something, right? And it's, I like to think of it as...
of your findings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I like to think of, you know, JS work is more the end product and working backwards. So I do this with my other job too. I ask a client, well, what are you actually trying to achieve here? And then I try to work the steps back to create that result, right? And mm-hmm. Paul worked with me and my company on a project out in Nevada a couple of years ago. And another company was partnered with us to do the GIS work and also some of the survey. And, you know, we basically needed to know, well, where can we survey? Because the variables were slope. The mm-hmm. Forest Service didn't want us looking at anything over 30%. Right. And then also we needed to know like access and you know, properties and then the segments that we were actually surveying at that time, because there was a lot of different segments out there. So those are all the variables and they needed to have, you know, pretty high resolution topographical maps of that whole mountain range, because there's a lot of topography out there.
Right.
And then understand, you know, some other bits and pieces too. And they put all that together and you end up with a map that says, survey there. And we tried to shade all those in. Yeah. So,
right.
And that's what I needed.
That was, don't survey here because you're going to fall off the side of the hill.
Right. Exactly. So it's so handy. And, you know, I don't necessarily need a heavy knowledge of GIS to get that. I need somebody and I need to be able to give them the information that I need and articulate it in a way that I can use, but also in a way that they can understand to provide the result. Because the GIS department sometimes, especially at bigger firms, I've noticed, I don't know how it is where you work, but they're not often archaeologists, right? They're GIS specialists.
Well, that's why I was hired. That's exactly right. Where I was hired. I was hired to be that liaison. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. That's good. So you can translate those, you know, those differences back and forth, right? You have to be that person that can interpret both sides.
Right.
That idea of being able to translate, I think, is really important. Chris, you raised it twice now about what's your end result? You know, your end result isn't to have a drill, it's to have a hole, the right size in the right place. And that's something that in IT, I was asking constantly. People would say, oh, I've got this problem. And they'd tell me what they tried to do to solve it without actually explaining what the problem was in a way that it was mm-hmm. broken down to the, I tried to do X and Y happened. And that's, you know, so I'd always have to roll back all their questions back to that point. And it seems to me that because we use GIS so heavily in its basic, just using the tool form for making figures, like Heather's saying, and in more advanced forms, like what she's advocating for as analyses, it seems to me that having people in the business that can translate or can speak this common language, I think is really useful. I would like to hear what Heather has to say about that, because I'm sure that's something she bumps into all the time.
You mean how to communicate?
How to communicate effectively what the sets of expectations and goals are when you're talking about products that intersect with GIS, that either they're, right. they're whether they're figure creation or analyses,
right.
but I are part of that workflow.
That's such a very good question. But we have a fairly large GIS department, and we have some that we really prefer to work with. I mean, it's because, you know, they just get it, you know, they've caught on, they're into analysis, they're very like detail oriented, they're really interested in archaeology. So even though they're not archaeologists, they love doing the figures because it gives them at least some kind of window into what we do. Mm-hmm. And then there's others that we've worked with for a while, so they know exactly what we want. So communicating, I think the best way, if you've never done GIS, the best way to think about it is that GIS works in layers. And it's, and I'm going to age myself here, but when I was younger and I was into, you know, I was into like history, I was kind of a nerd, and I was into history, and I was always curious. Yes, we all were. I was curious how an area changed over time. And I thought to myself, you know, I could take, you know, transparencies that you put on an overhead and draw each, you know, have a map of each time period, and then put those things on top of each other and look at how things change. So that was what was in my head. And since that's what's been in my head, that's how I always see GIS. When you're communicating with a GIS analyst, you need to explain to them how you want your information layered. That's like very key. And sometimes they'll help you with that too. Another thing that's important is how do you use symbology to communicate so many different pieces of information. That's hard. Yeah. And it, you know, not everybody, not every GIS analyst is good at that. And that's where I think I wish that GIS programs spent more time on cartography than some do. There's some that don't spend hardly any. There's a whole theory behind cartography. There's a there's an art behind it. There's some amazing books out there that are literal art pieces. You don't even know you're looking at a map and you're looking at a map. If you're looking at it, you actually, in your head, your brain, your cognitive, you know, your brain tells you you're looking at the map. But if you just walked by it, you would think you're looking at a piece of art, if that makes sense. And so we all think we have to have a box and we have to have roads and we have to have, you know, these things that, you know, every map has to have. And then you realize that's not true. There's so much noise on maps that don't need to happen. Mm-hmm. But that's the art of GIS, is figuring out what is noise and what is important. Mm-hmm. But then also with you know, in the our business, when you're working with environmental firms, there's also has to be some kind of consistency. So people expect a map to look a certain way. So you can only play with it a certain amount. But what I love are those projects where we're actually working on a project right now, where it's a really important village site near our office. And at one point, it was an island in the middle of a very large slough. And it was big. And the island in the 40s was just taken down by, I don't know, like, it was, I don't know, 3/4 of it was taken and used as fill to fill in the slough so they could have an airport there during wartime. And so, you know, quite a bit of it's gone, unfortunately, but being able to communicate, we have one figure that worked. I worked with GIS quite a bit to demonstrate how the island was, but thankfully that didn't happen until like the 40s. So we have a decent amount of historic aerials that have this, the island, and then, you know, what happened to it. And then looking at all the different excavations that have happened. It's actually one of those sites that people would give their right arm to excavate at. We actually happen to be doing a data recovery at it right now. And, you know, being able to identify the areas that have been looked at already, take all the data that so that we know where we have potentially intact or known intact deposits. And it's a lot of information on one figure. But I think we came up with a pretty good figure that anyone, even if they're not archaeologists, can look at it and understand it.
Cool. Nice. Well, that's actually a good segue, because I wanted to do some of the stuff you guys have worked on or are currently worked on that's interesting and has some good analysis or analytical techniques and things like that, or some fun maps. And we'll do that on the other side of the break in our final segment. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast. This is our final segment, episode 198. And Heather, this go around, you led right into it with your last example at the end of segment two, but I wanted to talk about some interesting scenarios you've had working for this company in the past, or maybe even currently, where you guys had to do something that wasn't just a line drawing field map, which is probably 70% or 80% of what a GIS department ends up doing, location maps and site maps, but some really cool, interesting stuff and some out of the box kind of thinking that had to happen from a GIS standpoint.
Yeah, I think just off the top of my head, the first thing that I think of is an experience that we had when we were working with tribes and they were consulting on a project. And there's some times where there's just a distrust of, and for good reason, of the data sets that we as archaeologists use on a regular basis. One of those things is in California, it's called CRIS, which is the mm-hmm. database for all, site records and former reports. There's a lot of holes in that, right? It's all dependent on whether or not people turn in their site records, turn in their reports. So there can certainly be negative bias. And tribes are definitely concerned with that. And also, so you did turn in a site record, or you did turn in some, you did do an investigation, you turn in your report. Maybe they are not all that convinced that the investigation you did was all that, appropriate, or that you came to the findings you should have. And so that your methodology was flawed. And so, just because we have information doesn't mean that's all that convincing to some people. And mm-hmm. so, the one thing, it's just helping out with this informal consultation that eventually helped inform the formal consultation. And I came up with an idea to look at all the sites, because they were convinced this one area had to have a site there. And I knew, looking at the landscape, I just didn't make sense to me that there would be one there, but I knew that's not enough. And I don't blame them for being critical of that. And so having something where we could actually say, this is data, not what do we know? Are there sites here? But looking at what, like I was saying before, the predictive modeling and looking at the sites, because there were quite a few sites around the area, which many people say, if you have sites surrounding an area, then, you have a higher probability of this area that hasn't been looked at having a site. Well, not necessarily, because you have to look at the natural landscape, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. what all good archaeologists do. And so, but being able to communicate that, not just with a map, but be able to communicate that with all the data and demonstrate that we've taken all the data and all the understanding that we have of the natural landscape into play, and we've incorporated it into this analysis and come up with findings that were more believable. And so that is what we did. It almost covered an entire quadrangle of the topo map. So it was a pretty big area. And so we did that. We also did one, what's, happening a lot out here right now is wildfire protection plans. So you don't have the time to go and survey everywhere in a wildfire protection plan, because it is literally an entire county, it can be, right? Or an entire city. So how do you do that? How do you figure out where you might have a potential of having an archaeological site? And so all that was, predictive modeling and finding areas of sensitivity and a gradation of sensitivity, and then preparing mitigation measures that were appropriate for each level of sensitivity. I really love projects like that.
And just for context, for our Eastern United States listeners, or Europe for that matter, some of the California counties are probably bigger than the state or country you live in. So they're pretty huge.
The largest county in the United States is in Southern California.
San Bernardino, isn't it?
San Bernardino
County? Yeah. That's what I thought. Yeah, that county's enormous. Like you can be somewhere you didn't even think you were near it, and you just pass a sign that says entering San Bernardino County. You're like, what? I'm in the Mojave. Yeah. What's going on? And then you're on the other side. Yeah, it's huge.
So. And you know, that really brings up a good point, because, you know, there's sometimes where you're walking into an area that you may not be all that familiar with. And that's where GIS mm-hmm. can be helpful. I think GIS can start you on the path to having good field methodology. Mm-hmm. Starting with GIS will really set you up to do your best work in the field. And sure. especially if you're mm-hmm. doing, like, we cover a huge area. So I can't go and just look, you know, I'm not going to know every single area. There's no way, like the back of my hand. Yeah. And so GIS really helps with that.
Nice. Yeah, I'll agree. I mean, Chris was talking about the slope write-offs that we had in Nevada. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd mentioned on a previous episode about being told to dig for the foundations of a building in one location. And then I looked at the LIDAR hillshade for that area, and I could see the foundations where they actually were, which is where right. we thought they were based off of, you know, having dug STPs all over that area. And then we could verify and argue for, hey, why we really should look for the foundations of the building here, not where we were told to initially.
Right.
Which would have been avoided had it all yes. started in GIS.
Yep.
And that's part of, you know, obviously what we're doing here. It's not just for communication, but for just logistics. I mean, mm-hmm. logistical planning, mm-hmm. right?
You know, you were talking about slopes. So one of the largest project I'd ever worked on, which is, have to say, probably one of my favorites, was something called the Santa Susana Field Laboratory, which is in the San Fernando Valley area. We're right on the edge of the LA County and Ventura County and Southern California. And it's where NASA is on there. NASA is on there, and Boeing. And there was mm-hmm. an accident that happened back in the 60s. And so it was a cleanup, super fun cleanup site. And the original archaeologists that had done work in that area had only found, like, there's a rock art site that's probably one of the most well-known rock art sites in the United States, called Burrell Flats, or at least it's very impressive. You don't know about it, look it up.
Hmm.
And so everybody knew that that was there, because people have known that for a while. It's a solstice site, but they had only looked at they had all just said, okay, we're not going to look at slopes because there's no habitation that would happen up there and everything. And so they only found like five sites in this entire 6,000 acre area project site. And after we were done, there was almost 200 sites that were there. And that was because, you know, that, you know, you have all this rock art is typically in rock shelters, right? And so, you know, looking at where in the slope idea, I understand the slope idea, but that's where GIS can help you. And you can say, okay, well, what is out there? If there is anything on a slope, what is out there? And then looking at, you know, outcrops and mm-hmm. geological outcrops, and actually looking at the landscape to see, okay, we're not going to do the slope, but let's see if there is a potential of having other types of sites out there, and at least mm-hmm. pinpointing those areas and looking at them. So you're not have these blinders on and miss almost 200 sites.
So Heather, let's round this out. You've given a pretty full-throated argument for why GIS done right is a good thing. Can you give us just a few examples before we go about things you'd like to see more of, or things you'd like to see less of by people using GIS or not mm. using GIS in CRM in particular, but archaeology in general?
Oh, geez.
just a simple little question.
Yeah. I would say, first of all, not creating maps for the sake of creating maps. I think that when you have a map, it's got to mean something. Mm. And other than your figure one, figure two, which in many cases agencies require, but having a bunch of maps for the sake of having a bunch of maps doesn't make sense. And then the other, and it just confuses things. Remember, the reports that we write have got to be palatable to the reader. And many times, those are not archaeologists. And so mm-hmm. you have to look at what is it you're trying to communicate. So if you are, I see this, I don't say a lot, but I see this, you know, when you're looking through reports that other people have done to kind of gather information about your project, you see people that kind of step into the information that they're giving with maps. So they'll have multiple iterations of pretty much the same map where they just keep adding mm-hmm. new information on top, right? And that, it's not helpful. Like if you have, to me, I think in some instances, maybe it's helpful, but for the most part, it's not. So if you had several maps that every time you're adding some kind of a layer, what would you, or you're not adding a layer, you're saying, okay, I'm only going to give this information on this map. So I have a project site and I get this information on the overlaid on top of the project site. And then the next one, I say, okay, now I'm going to give you this information. I'm going to take away the old information. I'm going to put a new data set on here. Well, what I would do is I would lay all those maps up and I would be trying to compare. Well, that's not what GIS is meant for. GIS is meant for you to be able to look at all the information at one time. That's why we have georeferencing, why we have the ability to actually spatially tie information. It's not just the data. Let's say we have maps, we have historic aerials, all these things that we can spatially tie so we can more accurately overlay things on pieces of information on top of each other and really see where information pops out that make you want to look at that area more than another. And so I would say having too many maps that is to me kind of a not a pet peeve, but just I would say people need to kind of rethink that approach.
Yeah.
I see it a lot. And I think that it might just be because a person's not a GIS person, so they don't see it like that. And you may have, let's say you have an archaeologist that says you have to do it this way. I mean, basically, they're just asking for GIS to give them a digital form of their handwritten map. That's not what GIS is for. You know, Right. That's a lot of work for nothing. Just do your handwritten map if that's what you're going to do, unless your handwriting is that bad. But behind those kinds of approaches is a very frustrated GIS person, I'm sure, that's saying, I could totally put this in one figure if you would just let me. So,
yeah,
that gets at some of the ideas that you were talking about earlier about symbology and GIS programs and also about communication and, you know, having a shared language that we can understand. You don't have to necessarily flatten everything into each map just shows one kind of feature, but you can smartly show them all, provided you've got, you know, good GIS people on one side and archaeologists are willing to work with them on the other side.
Right.
Yeah. And one of the things I was thinking of, Heather, when you were saying, you know, GIS is not about just digitizing hand-drawn maps. I mean, as a small company owner, when I was first starting out, honestly, I had a cursory knowledge of GIS. I took one graduate class in GIS just to kind of get my feet wet. And then when I became started owning my own company, I couldn't afford ArcGIS. So I was using QGIS, mm-hmm. which was fine, and doing my own tutorials and just kind of figuring out what I needed to do. But I learned really early on when I did have to digitize, not necessarily hand-drawn maps, but in some cases hand-drawn maps, but in a lot of cases just making a map out of something I made in the field. You know, I didn't need a complicated GIS tool. I actually used some other stuff on my iPad to create those maps with their, you know, spatial relationships just to communicate the idea, because that was the easiest tool for the job. And I didn't use GIS to do that. And, you know, I ended up, you know, having more projects and getting more stuff rather than, again, staying in your lane, right? Rather than me trying to spend all this time and figure this out and do a good job. Like I hired a contractor, somebody I knew who was a GIS specialist to do the GIS work for me, because, you know, that's going to cost me money, but it's way less money than me trying to spend my time trying to do it. So, yeah, but I was able to communicate to him because of my knowledge of what I needed and the process, you know, exactly what I wanted out of his work. And that was a good relationship to have. So,
yeah, I think that same project that I was talking about, at the time it was a smaller company and they didn't have the money for a Trimble or anything like that. So we actually did the old fashioned compass and tape recording of all these sites. It was a lot. And because at the time I was actually in that graduate program for GIS, I thought right away, I'm like, you know what, we need to set up a convention, a symbology convention now. We have to have so that the symbology is across the board the way it needs to be. So it's consistent so that one person isn't using this. I mean, that's, if you look at Sanborn's, there's some convention there. There's some consistency, but there's not. And that's like, usually you're trying to figure out what does this mean? You know?
Yeah.
You know, I think that that is also something that GIS can do, you know, with companies. If you have a smaller company, even larger companies may not have it, just putting together a data dictionary, putting together an actual set symbology. And then that could be tied to technologies like collector and other, so that when you're finding things in the field, that you're using that same symbology across the board. It really cuts down on time and expense. And it also, once you start training people what to look for, it's more intuitive to them.
Yeah. So in the last just couple minutes here of this podcast, Heather, this has been great. You mentioned to us during the break that you might have a few books for people to check out, and we'll put links for these in the show notes. But what were you thinking?
So there's a few books. Some are just for fun and some are actually really, I think, good resources. So there's one that's a good resource. If you don't know, it is a thicker book and it's many times used as a textbook in a GIS program, but it's called GIS Fundamentals, a First Text on Geographic Information Systems by Bolstad. That's a really good comprehensive textbook type resource. And then there are a few others that kind of talk about like the theory of maps and how they came to be and why we as humans, we have a map in our head. I mean, there's no, I'd like you to bring one person to me that doesn't walk around and have a map in their cognitive map, right? Where they are right now. I mean, it's whether you think about it or not, you do have a map ongoing in your head all the time. So
I'm pretty sure my mother doesn't.
What's that? But your mom
doesn't? I'm pretty sure my mother doesn't, but go ahead.
So, well, it may not be that great of a map, but she has one. So, so there's one called You Are Here, and that's called, it's You Are Here is the name. That's by Catherine Harmon. It's called Personal Geographies and Other Maps of the Imagination. And then a fun one is Maps That Changed Our World by John O.E. Clark. And then one that's really just fun to look at the pictures as art, or the maps as art, is Everything Sings, Maps for Narrative Atlas, or a Narrative Atlas by Dennis Wood. And that's a fun one. It's just looking at how they communicate information in these maps. It's pretty cool. And it gives an explanation too of why they made it the way they did each map.
Well, that's awesome. I'm going to throw this off into left field really quickly here before we wrap up. The other day I was having a conversation with my sister, who's an artist and an arts educator, and she gave as an assignment to one of her classes, do a map of your childhood neighborhood.
Nice.
And it became this incredibly intense discussion about what is a map and, you know, how important is the realism and the spatial accuracy versus the effective accuracy, you know, what you remember, what matters and so on. And so I think that some of these books are actually going to really help her. And she has nothing to do with archaeology.
Yeah, for sure. Yes. I mean, you know, when you're looking at maps and it's, size doesn't mean that let's say you're looking at a neighborhood and you have a size, you have a one house that's bigger on your map than all others. It doesn't necessarily mean that that was the biggest house on the block, right? That might've been your most important house, right? Your house or your best friend's house, or, you know, there's so many different ways of communicating information. Maps. Maps are so much fun.
Nice. All right. Well, Heather, this has been great. I'm glad we finally connected on this show. And if you guys want to hear more of, you know, Heather's ideas and opinions, check out the CRM Archaeology Podcast here on the Archaeology Podcast Network. It comes out every Sunday. No, we record every Sunday. I don't even know. It's been 10 years. It comes out every Wednesday, every other Wednesday. Yes, I'll get it right eventually. You'd think after that long, I would know. But yeah, we have some great discussions over there focused solely around the job of cultural resource management and all the aspects regarding that. And in fact, we've got a lot of interesting topics, but it's usually focused around CRM. So check that out. And again, Heather, thanks for coming on the show. This has been great.
Thanks for having me. This has been really fun. I don't get to talk about, you know, GIS in this kind of way very often. So thank you.
Yeah.
Well, we've been trying to have you on for a while, so it's great that we finally did. And it's great to finally actually kind of virtually meet you after hearing you on the CRM podcast for so long.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks, Heather. And thanks, everybody else. And we'll see you guys in a couple of weeks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the ArchaeoTech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.archpodnet.com/ArchaeoTech.
Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugal.com. Support the show by becoming a member at archpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.